Hey guys, welcome. Jim Manning here with the Passive Wealth Show. What this show is designed to do is to help people build passive wealth investing in real estate so that one day they can replace their income. Our team here has generated 100% passive income on over $250 million invested with us over the last 15 years. So I'm here to share some of the lessons that I've learned along the way to pay it forward for all the help that I've received over the years. So onward and upward, my friends. Here's to true passive wealth. Let's get going on the show.
I think everybody wants to look at the best case scenario of any investment. And I think that's human nature. Like, what could this investment do for me in my life? I'm always looking at the other side and saying, what is the downside? Like, how can we better protect the downside? And the lesson that I learned is you need to understand what game you're playing when you're trying to invest money. And you also need to understand, what are the games that I can play when I invest money that give me the greatest advantage? If you want to be on the Forbes billionaires list, my not financial advice recommendation to you is to concentrate your wealth.
Hey guys, Jim Manning here with another episode of the Passive Wealth Show. Today we have Jacob Turner on the line. Jacob is a financial advisor with Moment Private Wealth, former professional athlete. I guess you're always a professional athlete once you get there. I unfortunately was just a college guy. He's far more accomplished athletically than me. And just generally just a good guy here in St. Louis. So I'm excited to have you, Jacob. And how about we just go back to your professional days as an athlete and that transition into wealth management and kind of what all went into that and why you got into wealth management in the first place to kick the convo off.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think everybody talks a lot about athletes transitioning out of the game. And look, it's really hard when you've done anything your whole life and that's what you've poured every sense of energy, every sense of effort into it. Then all of a sudden you're transitioning to something else. It can be really challenging. But I think for me, my transition was interesting because, as you mentioned, we started a company, Moment Private Wealth, where we help athletes and entrepreneurs build and protect wealth. I kind of always knew I wanted to do something outside of baseball. And I think for me, it was a natural transition. So to give a little background on my story, at 18, I signed for millions of dollars. I was the ninth overall pick in the draft. And I went from having a few hundred dollars in my bank account to millions of dollars overnight. And really, I took it on myself to try to learn and understand, like, hey, who should I be hiring? What questions should I be asking? And this is going from 18, where I essentially knew nothing, to the time when I retired from baseball at 29. And I felt like I was really well educated, pretty well versed on all the different planning concepts I should be thinking about, whether that be investing, taxes, risk management, estate planning, and so on and so forth. And it really became a natural transition for me as I got out of the game. I said, you know, I wanted to try to educate people around personal finance. I've never loved the term financial advisor, so I wasn't 100% sure if I wanted to become a quote unquote financial advisor. But here we are, 3.5 years later, we've been building this business and it's been a ton of fun.
Well, I'm glad we're here. I'm glad we're here. So, okay. So then when you, what did you want to do when you founded Moment Private Wealth? Like what was some of the differentiators that you try and do?
Yeah, I think the first and foremost thing is when we think of wealth management, one of my biggest gripes with this industry is it is very generic advice for everybody. And essentially think about it like this, Jim. Somebody comes to a typical financial advisor and really what they want to get at is like, financial advisor wants to know, how much money do you have that I can manage? Because that's going to dictate what your fee is. And I'm going to tell you if you're going to be a good client or not. And on the flip side of that, the way that we've structured Moment is we've said like, hey, first and foremost, like you need to be an athlete, an entrepreneur, or potentially a key employee where like there's not only complexity that we understand, but there's complexity that we feel like we can be the best in the world at helping you. There's a lot of folks that might come to us and say, hey, I think you could help us. And the reality is like, yes, we could. But am I the best in the world at helping retirees? No, because that's not what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. So as I think about our business, it's really specialized in saying, we want to help the people that one, we enjoy working with, two, we've walked in their shoes, and three, we have the actual expertise to be able to help them.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you said you've walked in their shoes before. So like, let's go into the 18-year-old millionaire. Congratulations. It's amazing. And like, what were some of the lessons you learned over that 10-year span of trying, you know, as an 18-year-old trying to manage a few, you know, whatever millions you got in the signing bonus and all that?
Yeah. So, well, I think the first thing is don't be afraid to ask questions. I think a lot of times people are afraid to ask questions because they think they're going to sound silly or that it's going to be a stupid question, or I should quote unquote know the answer to that. One thing I learned early on was it is fine to ask questions, especially if that's not your area of expertise. And in fact, I would encourage everybody to ask questions because, like, especially when it comes to money, like, this is something that I think a lot of people don't talk about. It's like taboo. Like, oh, don't talk about money. We never talk about it in a public setting. So unless maybe you work with a financial professional or you have a really good relationship with your CPA or your attorney, you're almost never talking about money. It's like this subject that, like, just kind of gets put to the back burner. I would encourage everybody out there, like, ask questions, like, have open conversations, have open dialogue about it, because that's frankly how I learned a lot of what I learned, was just doing it on my own, asking those questions, sometimes learning lessons the hard way. The second thing I would say is, depending on, you know, what you're looking to do, one of the biggest red flags I see, and something that I ran into, was I saw somebody else doing something and it was maybe working for them, maybe it wasn't, but it sure looked like it was working. So I thought, like, well, if they're doing it, I should do it too. And I know we're going to talk a little bit later about investing and, you know, real estate versus the stock market, and all these different ways that you can invest money. The reality is, like, there's a million ways out there that you can make money. It doesn't mean that everybody should do it one way or the other way. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I preach to clients, is just because somebody else is doing it and they're really good at doing it and maybe it is working, doesn't mean that you should be doing it. And that's certainly something that I learned along the way.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. There's a lot of nuances between different people's situations. And, you know, like, one of our things that we have is an equity fund that's 5 years. It's a long-term investment, and the liquidity, it's a fantastic investment, but the liquidity doesn't always mesh well with people we talk to's needs, right? And it doesn't take away that how good of an investment it is. It's just like, well, every investment needs to be a win-win, right? So so you mentioned having some hard lessons in that first decade. And I'm not going to let you off the hook after you said that. Let's go into
yeah.
Oh,
baby. Yeah, let's talk about it.
Like, let's get into a specific example here, Jacob.
Yeah, we'll talk two specific examples. So one of them is a form of insurance that I bought when I first signed. And really the lesson that I learned in this was, whenever you're working with any professional, no matter what the industry is, you need to understand how they're compensated and you need to understand what the potential conflicts of interest might be. So in this example, the insurance product that I bought, while not the worst product in the world, was certainly not the best product that I could have bought. But it did pay the advisor a lot of money. All right. Now, let me just say, as somebody who owns a financial advising company, there's nothing wrong with making money from really good financial advice. In fact, I would argue that you should be paying for financial advice, because oftentimes that's going to give you the best outcome. But you need to understand, okay, what am I actually paying for? In my scenario, what I was really paying for was, like, the product. I wasn't actually paying for any advice. They wanted to push a product that they felt was quote unquote suitable for me. And what I would tell you is, like, you know, it was like a 4, 5, 6 out of 10 product for my situation. It didn't really fit my needs, much like you just talked about with your equity fund. Mm-hmm. It could be a great investment for somebody. It could be a terrible investment for somebody else that actually wants the money in a year or two, right? So I think one of those lessons, and really the takeaway for me in that situation, was understanding, hey, what are the potential conflicts of interest in anything that somebody's potentially recommending to me? Two, understanding, like, why do I need this product, this solution over something else? So that goes back to what we talked about earlier, asking questions. Excuse me. And the second lesson that I would say I learned, that's a specific example, was, I would say it was probably 2000. So I signed in 2009. I think it was around 2015. And, you know, if we think back on the economy from 2009 to 2015, I tell people, like, I'm the greatest market timer ever, because from 2009 to 2015, the market essentially went straight up outside of a few bumps in the road. Yet here I was looking at, you know, some of these individual stocks, whether it was bank stocks or whether it was some of the tech stocks, some of the financial stocks that had gotten crushed in 2009, 2008, and said, well, I see how much money they made from 2008, 2009 to 2015. And I was invested more in different sorts of funds, very diversified portfolio. And I got a little bit like, I want to have some of that, right? And I remember we ended up purchasing a couple of individual stocks. Some of them did great. Well, one of them in particular did terrible. Okay? It did so bad that I remember it was like a week after I bought it. They had come out with their earnings. And all that means is they come out with their quarterly report to say, here's how good the business did, good or bad. And here's what we think it's going to do in the future. Now, again, this is my responsibility. Although I had an advisor, like, I hadn't done any real research on these companies. It was kind of like, I saw it on my stocks app on my phone and thought, like, this would be a good idea. And I remember that that stock went down 50% within 7 days of me buying it. And the lesson that I learned is you need to understand what game you're playing when you're trying to invest money. And you also need to understand, what are the games that I can play when I invest money that give me the greatest advantage? So if we could think about that example, in 2015, I was 25 years old. And my greatest advantage is that I have more time on my side than 99% of investors, because I got all this money up front. Mm-hmm. And what I would say is, like, going back and looking at it over again, the advice I would give myself is say, like, hey, Jacob, you don't have to hit another home run, right? Like baseball, the contract I signed, like that was a home run. Yeah. I don't have to hit another home run. Yet here I was trying to hit another home run. So the two biggest lessons were, you know, an insurance policy that I don't think was in my best interest that I purchased. Again, I didn't ask enough questions on it. And the second thing was trying to hit a home run with an investment that I really didn't have any expertise in, and I had no real unfair advantage in.
So you got into more of like a, hey, let's protect and grow the wealth, and like learning that the hard way. And you know, what's funny is we don't a lot of times think about this, but if you have $100 and you lose half of it, right, that is a 50% loss. But to get back to break even, now you have to have 100% gain to get just yep. back to where you started, right? And like, I don't know about you, Jacob, but there's a lot of times when I talk to really high net worth individuals, there's a high, not all of them, but there's a high percentage of them that are very concerned with wealth preservation and what the downside risk is, as much as what the maximizing what the upside is on these investments, because they know that, man, like if I just have that one mistake, oh, it takes a grand slam maybe to be able to get back to where I should have been had I just been hitting base hits or doubles the whole time. Have you found that to be the case too, Jacob? You're talking to more people than I do, right?
Yeah, 100%. Look, I think everybody wants to look at the best case scenario of any investment. And I think that's human nature. Like, what could this investment do for me in my life? I'm always looking at the other side and saying, what is the downside? Like, how can we better protect the downside? And maybe that's how we position the investment. Maybe that's how much money we put in the investment. There's all these different factors that come into play. But for me, I'm always saying, like, I want to make sure that we're protecting the downside in this situation, as opposed to looking at the upside. It's very easy to look at any deck from any potential investment and say, well, look at the upside. Like, if this hits, this is going to return 10, 15, yeah. 20% IRRs. Okay, well, what if it doesn't hit? Because the reality is, typically the further you go up on the spectrum in terms of what you think the IRR is going to be or what you think the return is going to be, the more you're turning up that risk dial. So you need to understand, hey, I'm not going to get 15, 20% return on my money by not taking pretty significant risk and maybe some leverage with it. Mm-hmm. Again, doesn't mean it's inherently a bad thing, but you need to understand, what is the downside case of that scenario?
Yeah, and we, it's interesting as you say that. I think back to like our first pro forma that we did for our first fund. And this was back in the beginning of 22 is when we started looking into it. Even though we had been investing for like 15 years before that on our own. And I bet you it was like a month of my time pouring into, let's get this pro forma like perfect to a T, you know, have it all set up right. And I get to like one of my first investor meetings, and he looked at it like as if it was a piece of toilet paper. And I'm like, well, wait, what? Like, come on, I spent all this time on it. Like, I'm very confident in it. And he said, well, it's like every pro forma is going to look good. Like, you know, no matter what investment you're looking at, everyone says it looks good. But yeah, he wanted to know the risk. And if it didn't go according to plan, how likely was it that he was going to lose his money or potentially lose all his money, or at least have it the risk mitigated to where he could protect his wealth, yep. right? That's absolutely the case. Yeah.
Think about it like this. The way I describe it is like, if you look at the Forbes billionaire list, it's full of people that have concentration of their wealth, right? It's essentially the only way to get on the billionaires list. Like, you have to go all in, win, go all in again, win, go all in again, and just keep repeating that cycle over and over again. I mean, look at the billionaires list. It's typically people that started a company, the company went public, and they still own a lot of shares of that company. Mm-hmm. All right. If you want to be on the Forbes billionaires list, my not financial advice recommendation to you is to concentrate your wealth, right? Yeah. For the rest of everybody else, I don't know about you, Jim, I don't care about being on the Forbes billionaires list. I want to be able to live a really good life, use money as a tool in my life, and make sure that my wealth is preserved for the long term. Then you need to look at diversification, right? And like, to me, I think that's oftentimes, to go back to a point I made earlier, people see a game somebody else is playing and they think that they should play that game without really realizing, like, well, what game are they really playing? And like, do they have an unfair advantage in that game they're playing that you don't have? Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, and it's difficult judging people's outsides or comparing your insides to someone's outsides, right? You just don't know everything. You know, and one of the most successful individuals I ever worked with was a self-made billionaire. And as I got to know him, I realized that he was one of the more unhappy individuals I've ever met in my life too. And, you know, I think a lot of times we get in the trap of equating like, well, if my net worth's a certain amount bigger than what it is today, then I'll be happier. Then I'll be able to spend time with my family and all of that. And you just don't, yeah, if you're putting everything on the line in the same strategy, like, yeah, how you're not gonna be able to be that present with family because you got everything at risk on the newest business adventure, and you got to make sure that it goes and it hits, right? So, this is fascinating. So what else have you learned along the way? So you started advising 4 years ago in like 2020.
Yep, we started the business about 4 years ago. And yeah, I think one thing I would say is, I think you'll probably see this as well in your business, is money is inherently personal. And the decisions that we make with money typically reflect some sort of experiences that we've had. But I think it's really important for people to understand that the decisions that you make with money, the experiences you have with money, that's 0.00000001% of what happened in the rest of the world around money. So oftentimes we can have huge blind spots when it comes to money and finances. We can think like, this is the only way that you can do it. And typically you think that because like maybe you've had success doing it that way, but really maybe it's not the best way to do it. Maybe you should be asking questions and exploring other options out there. You might've had a really bad experience. Let's talk about real estate. Let's say the first property that you invested in went into foreclosure. Mm-hmm. Chances are 2 or 3 years later, if Jim came to you and said, hey, I had this great fund, here's the track record we have, you're barely even going to hear anything. You're going to say, real estate's not for me. Yeah. Now, is that like a good take? Probably not, because you haven't even really heard out what the opportunity is. But again, it goes back to what your experience was. If your experience the first time was that negative, like I lost all my money, the house went or the property went into foreclosure, you're probably going to write off that investment the next time. So I think one of the things I've learned along the way is just being very aware of what experiences have you had in your own life. And that doesn't mean that it should shape your next decision, but it should, you should need to be cognizant of that to make sure that there's a blind spot there. You're not missing something.
Yeah. Are there, here's something like as you were talking that popped into my head. Are there any patterns you've noticed with people that have high net worths and that you're like, man, they're going to double their net worth in the next 10 years compared to maybe someone else that's, you know, maybe they're earning the same amount of money, but like you just kind of know, like at the end of the day, they're not going to be nearly as wealthy. Like what do you notice as you're having these conversations and then seeing what people's net worths end up doing?
So two things. One is, this is going to sound counterintuitive, I think the people that have the best opportunity to continue to grow their net worth always have sufficient liquidity. Okay. What I mean by that is they always have enough money. We call it the war chest, but they always have enough money in their war chest, whether that be cash, bonds, treasuries, something that they could tap into at a moment's notice. And the reason why that's so valuable is if you've never been through a cycle of investing where whatever investment you have goes down significantly in value, you've never experienced the fact that like having money in the war chest that's probably earning a lot less than what your actual investment portfolio is earning is so inherently valuable, because you're able to say like, I can keep letting this money over here continue to rebound and grow if we went from a peak down to a valley and then we have to go back to a peak. The second thing that I would say is, again, if we think about buckets to investing, we think about investing in three buckets. We think about the war chest, the core portfolio, and then the aspirational bucket. Oftentimes, the aspirational bucket is what gets somebody really rich. Okay. And what I mean by that is typically for us, especially for entrepreneurs, the aspirational bucket is typically money that's inside their business. Like that's the value of their business. And for most of the clients we work with, 90-95% of their money is in their business. But you got to remember, like the thing that they're the best in the world at doing is growing money inside that business, right? Like Jim, if you think about your situation, mm-hmm. you know, you guys are specifically focused on real estate, but not just real estate. Like, hey, I'm specifically focused on this type of real estate.
Yeah.
If in turn I said like, hey, Jim, I know you guys are really good at like this type of real estate, but on second thought, I think you should take everything and start deploying it over here. You'd be like, you know, like I'm not naive to think that like there's not other people that are great at that space. So one thing that comes to mind for me is like the people that take a little bit more risk, they turn that risk dial up, they're in bucket three with some of their money. They're doing it in a way that they have a competitive advantage. Okay. If we use another example, let's say I own a plumbing company and I've been doing plumbing for 20 years. I know the ins and outs of everything. I understand how the business works. I know what the service providers look like. I know what the tech stack looks like to build this business. I know who I need to hire, when I need to hire them, when busy season is, when slow season is. And you gave me $1 million. And you said, Jacob, my only thing is I want you to invest this money in a way that you think will give you the highest potential rate of return. I would say a large portion of that money should potentially go towards buying another plumbing company. Because that's the thing that you're the best in the world at doing. And the pitfall that I see is, we get shiny object syndrome where we see something else that somebody else is doing that somebody else is the best in the world at. And we're like, you know what? I'm gonna go do that thing. But the reality is like they're doing that thing and they're having success because they've been doing that thing for a really long time and they're an expert in that space.
That's so true. I have a friend who runs like a 300 person manufacturing company. And what they've been doing is investing as limited partners in different other manufacturing companies that then turn around and will need their core business to be able to produce some of the supplies and the materials. And
think about that example, right? Like when he's looking at their pro forma, when he's looking at their deck, when he's looking at their numbers, I guarantee he knows like, hey, here's what the top line should be. Here's what the profit margin should be. Mm-hmm. Hey, like your revenue per employee is either super low, super high. Hey, they have this relationship that I know is going to continue to grow. Hey, they're just scratching the surface on this part of their business. Those are all things that like he's probably able to look at in the first 60 minutes, be able to diagnose versus if you gave me and him both $1 million and you said, only rule is you got to go buy a manufacturing business, who are you going to put your money behind, right? It's not going to be me. Right. Like I don't have experience buying a manufacturing business and running it. And that's where I just think people need to understand, you need to lean into what your strengths are. It's the same way in sports. Like people think about we'll use baseball as an example. People think about a well-rounded baseball player. Well, I would actually argue instead of being a well-rounded baseball player, I would rather be a baseball player that has one or two like super outlier tools. Like I have 80 grade power on a scouting scale. Scouting scale is 20 to 80. So 80 grade power is like, we're talking Kyle Schwarber, Aaron Judge type power. We're like, I could hit 40 home runs in a season. I would rather have that tool than be like this all around player that has like average tools across the board.
That's right. Yeah. 40. What is average 40?
So MLB average is about 45 to 50.
Okay. So that's still pretty dang good. You think of it like, why don't they just do it on like 100 scale? Why do they got to like,
you would think
goofy on the
you
80? Would think. Like, oh man. Now I'm going to like Google Jacob Turner's scouting report and figure out where you grade it out. No, I'm joking. But
a few pitches definitely graded out as league average. Unfortunately, no pitches graded out as those outlier pitches, which is why I'm sitting here and talking to you about this today instead of being in the big leagues. And a few graded out as below average. So I got a question for you as we talk about investing, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about in real estate. I think one of the biggest advantages that you have is you can strategically use leverage to enhance returns, enhance the potential outcome, mm-hmm. but it can also be this double-edged sword, right? It's something that we talk a lot to our clients about, whether it's in their business, whether it's an investment they're making, you know, like how leveraged are they? So as you've grown in your career and you've experienced certain economic cycles, you've experienced growth of your guys' business, you're investing more now than you guys have probably ever invested in the past. You own more properties now. How has your thought either changed on potentially leverage previously to how it is now? Or how do you guys think about that now as you've already built a pretty well-oiled machine?
What a powerful, fantastic question. Do we have another hour, guys? So the 30-second answer to that is we were very aggressive when we were younger and we tried to grow with the least amount of money possible. Like we would do 100% leverage on not only purchase price, but repair money. And then we were flipping a bunch of properties. And so what we realized was the amount of deals we do was only limited to the amount of capital we could raise when we did that model. So we got up to 250 flips in 2012. Wait, no, we started doing 100 flips a year in 2011. And then 250 was like in 2017, something like that. But what happened was that created a dynamic where it didn't matter how good our previous year was. Like, we had to hit on the deals that we did this year because we were growing the amount of deals we did, right? Mm. And we got, because the market was going up, we got away with it. But had the market had any sort of correction, it's possible we would have gone under. So we are much more conservative now. Like in our equity fund, I mean, we're putting 40% down of equity on the properties, and are really setting ourselves up for to have a fortified structure and to have it be successful in any market. And I mean, real estate, I mean, there's Harvard guys saying that, hey, we're in a housing shortage through 2038, by the way, in single family real estate. So like, I don't think, even if there's maybe a year that's maybe a little bit of an ebb or a little bit of depreciation, we're not, because of the housing shortage, like, we're not going to see much other than sideways or up for the next over decade and a half minimum. But, you know, when you start to get more to lose, you start to, or at least I did, you know, I started to get more and more conservative and, you know, more concerned about protection than maximizing upside. Right. But, you know, that's just me. And, you know, I don't want everything to be hinging on what my next deal is. I already want that fortification, and yeah, I'll add on the next deal and we'll do well on it. But I don't want everything at risk. It's been way too many deals and way too much work, right? On it. So,
well, I think it's, I mean, it sounds similar to like what we talked about earlier with this notion of like, at the beginning, I think to build wealth, concentration can be an extremely valuable tool. Mm-hmm. And when I think about you, you mentioned like the people that you see that have the highest net worth, like, what's the tie-in? I think the easiest tie-in is like, those people bet on themselves, right? Like, they didn't wait around for somebody else to bet on them. They were like, you know what? Whether it was an athlete that was like, you know, every athlete at some point has been told that like, being a professional athlete, like, that is a pipe dream. Good luck with that. And they're like, okay, let me show you, right? They bet on themselves. Every entrepreneur, everybody in real estate, like, these people are betting on themselves and saying like, I think I can do this. Yeah. And I'm willing to take the risk to do it. And there's a lot of concentration in that risk. But then ultimately, like you said, Jim, like, for you guys, if you guys have had continued success, hey, maybe it makes sense to take some chips off the table, because now like the game for us, it looks a little bit different. And that's what, you know, I think the one thing I just want everybody to understand is you need to understand the game you're playing. Like, Jim 10 years ago is playing a different game than Jim is right now, right? So if you're looking at their success and you're saying like, I want to be like them, understand like, they might be at a different stage playing a completely different game than what you're playing.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I just talked to a 21-year-old kid and it was really endearing, because like, I could tell he was nervous, and I'm thinking to myself, why is he nervous? I'm just a guy, you know, like, why is he nervous? But he's like hearing everything we're doing now. And I'm like, dude, you have 7 rentals as a 21-year-old. I didn't even do my first deal till I was 24. Like, compare yourself to me when I was 24 and you're like kicking my butt. Like, don't, you know, like, it's okay. Just breathe. You'll be fine.
Well, what do they say? Comparison's the thief of joy. And I think everybody that's like a hard driver in life runs into that problem. Sometimes we see somebody that's 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years down the road from you, and you're like, man, like, look at all that they've done in business, right? But the reality is like, they've been doing it 2, 3, 4, 10 times longer than you have. I was telling my brother, who's my business partner, the other day, I said, you know, one of the biggest factors of success, one of the biggest key indicators for me is like, if you go to somebody's LinkedIn page and it says that they've worked at the same company that they've owned for the last 30 plus years, I'm like, chances are that guy's pretty successful. And I actually saw that the other day. We're using a home services company. They had a really great process. So I looked up the company. I found the guy on LinkedIn. I think he has been running the business for 45 years. I thought, well, that makes a ton of sense.
That's right. Yeah. And I love what you're saying about how like know yourself and your own journey and like what the upside is. Like even like doctors, for example, like you could give this same doc or a doctor completely different advice. Like the upside of a doctor typically would be, hey, start your own practice, you know, go yep. down that route, buy other practices up and like really grow the net worth through the business owner route. But I mean, how many like doctors want to do that or how many doctors is that the best thing for? Like, do you have the professional skills to be able to lead
100%
people like that?
All right.
Like,
let's talk about this in terms of real estate. Cause I think this is one of the biggest mistakes people make with real estate is say you're a business owner and you're like, you know what? I want to get into real estate. There's tax advantages. Like I'm seeing all these people, all the people that I know that have wealth. It's like, they're all talking about real estate. Okay. And one thing that I see over and over again is I think there's really two distinct ways that you can own real estate as an investment, right? You could invest in a fund like yours, Jim, yep. or you could go out and you could buy it individually, right? You could say like, I'm going to go do what Jim and his team are doing. And what I've seen over and over and over again, I'd be curious to hear what your perspective is on this. I am yet to see somebody who their main thing isn't real estate, be able to compete and have long-term success with real estate. And like, when I say success, like they built something out, they didn't buy like one Airbnb property, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is if we go back to the other example, the doctor example, they're competing against people like you, right? They're competing against 20 of you to go buy the same property you have. I see on the wall behind you guys, like there's probably numbers and expertise and data that you guys all have plus 15 plus years of experience to say, you know, this property is a winner. This property is a dud. We're not going to offer on this one. We're going to offer on this one. Here's how we're going to do it to gain a bigger advantage. Versus if I walked in and I had no real estate investing experience and I'm going up against you, it's like, I mean, this would be like a professional pitcher pitching against a high schooler. Yet you feel like you're on a level playing field. And that's where I think one of the biggest mistakes is like real estate can be a great part of somebody's investment portfolio, but understanding like, how should I go about building out that piece of the portfolio? I think is a huge thing that people miss.
So I have a couple theories on this and you know, this is just me talking guys. You know, this is what I've seen, but I think like it goes back to like grade school and like when we do our schooling, like a teacher, like if you try and like collaborate with a friend on a test, like you fail that test because it's like, no, you cheated. Right. Mm. And so we get into this headspace from school of like, I have to be the guy that has the answers. I have to be the guy that fills out all the bubbles correctly. It has to be me. And so then we get into the real world and maybe we're a successful plumber or doctor or whatever. And it is me. I'm the guy doing it. Me, my ego, I'm building it. And then you think, oh, well, I need real estate. I fall in love with the numbers, the depreciation, the passive income that can make me financially free. All of that's accurate. But we're still in that headspace of it needs to be me. Mm. But when we get into the real world, like when I have over 130 partners right now that are all making better returns than what I did for myself in my first 5 years of doing this full time. And it's, we've set it up. We figured it out. We've made a lot of mistakes along the way. And now we have a really good formula going into it. But if you can take a step back and think about it logically, like if you are a plumber or a self-employed person with 5 years, 10 years of experience, who knows how long of schooling, depending on the profession, you might've had another 10 years of schooling, depending on what you're doing, right? Like if the question is, hey, how do I maximize my net worth? It's going to be doubling down and doing more of what you're an expert at, taking that excess cash and teaching yourself how to be an investor and how to use that cash to then go out and work for you and generate you returns. And if you don't want to do that, that's great too. Become an expert at finding quality individuals like Jacob, who can be good stewards of your money too, right? But it has to like stop being like centrally focused on like, hey, you being the guy. And when you get into that collaboration mode, my goodness. And I don't know if you've ever read any of Robert Kiyosaki's stuff, the Rich Dad, Poor Dad author, but he has a whole cash flow quadrant and you start out as an employee, then you move to self-employed, which is you having a job that you own, but it's still a job. Mm-hmm. And then it goes to business owner, which is you have a system making money for you. But the last level is actually an investor. And the investor is the bucket that has the most upside, because you can, if you have enough money and you can go out and invest it prudently, well, like, think about the time, and you're able to leverage other people's time and other businesses and make a whole heck of a lot of more money. But, you know, if you're the one that wants to be the CEO and the guy on the, you know, on the billboard, so to speak, at some point there's going to be a limitation around that. Right.
Well, the other thing too, that I would add, I think to your point, spot on, this idea that we've been taught to do things on our own. Ask yourself, if you bought a property tomorrow, would you want to do everything on your own? Right. Yeah. Like, everything that a property entails. This isn't just the fun part where you get to find the property and you get to run the numbers and you get to do the deal and sign the closing documents. Like, no, this is the part where you have to call like 200 people cold to find the lead in the first place. You have to walk the property with a bunch of doubt in your mind. Like, can I actually turn this property around? And then once you do all the fun stuff, you have to actually get somebody in there. And then when the roof is leaking on Saturday night and they call you and say that we need somebody to fix it, you're showing up on Sunday morning. So those are all the things that it entails if you're doing it on your own. And that's where I think it's not to say you can't, but I just would tell you, like, there's just people out there that, like, they've been doing this for a long time and they have experts on their team that their only job is to do each one of those buckets, as opposed to you trying to run around and do all those different buckets.
That's right. Yeah. And it's more likely for you to generate better returns than what you, or equal returns to the, than for you to use other people than to, like, do it on your own.
I think people look at it too often and they compare it, but it's not apples to apples, right? Okay. Let's say you're a real estate investor and you invest in a couple syndications, right? So for people listening, if you don't know what syndications, just you're investing with a individual that's going out and buying multiple properties. Okay. They know what they're doing mostly. Okay. You still need to vet the deal. This is not financial advice. Versus if you go out and you buy a property on your own. All right. Like, you are spending your time and your money when you go out and buy a property on your own. On the other side, like, yes, you're going to spend some upfront time understanding, like, the deal, understanding if it makes sense for you. Like you mentioned at the beginning, Jim, like, does the liquidity of the fund make sense for you? But once you put that investment in, outside of if you want to listen to reports that they send out or read those, you're not spending your time doing this. Versus on the other side, like, you're still spending your time over and over again because you've really bought yourself another job, right? Like, yeah, you could make, maybe you're making 5% more on your money. And if that is valuable enough to you to spend however many hours you're doing that, by all means, go for it. And I'm not telling people they shouldn't do that. They just need to understand what they're getting into.
Well, and depending on how much your time's worth in your 9 to 5, you know, you might actually be taking a pay cut than if you just spent an extra couple hours a week, you know, an oral surgeon cracking more teeth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
well,
doing a couple extra surgeries, right? Like you're not going to actively make more money with your time as a real estate investor. You know,
you talk about rich dad, poor dad. You talk about those quadrants of cash flow and the fact that the investor is really the top quadrant. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my favorite books is The Almanac of Naval Ravikant, and Naval is one of the greatest venture capital investors out there, and he has a ton of great thoughts, theories, processes around building wealth. But one of the things that he mentions over and over and over again is from a really young age, he put a value on his time that was really high. And I don't want to get the numbers wrong, but let's say I think it was like $5,000 an hour is what he said. And he's like, it was really laughable at the time because I didn't have any money. So $5,000 an hour, like, but he's like, that was my mindset of if I'm going to do something, it's got to really be worth my time. And I think that's one of the biggest traps people fall into when it comes to building wealth is they say yes to everything and they forget the fact that, like, when you say yes to everything, you're giving up your time and you're not focused on the thing that, like, you can actually do to build wealth.
That's right. Oh, that's so right. So, hey, you have a podcast, Jacob.
We do.
It's not your name, right? It's what?
Yep. So the podcast we run is called The Long Game. So I do a ton of stuff on social media, whether it's YouTube, X, LinkedIn, Instagram. You'll find me posting most days on there. And then we also do a podcast, The Long Game. I do it with another financial advisor. And really we talk through strategies, whether it's taxes, estate planning, risk management, insurance, investing. And it's a kind of a collection of personal finance ideas, thoughts. We'll have some guests come on and talk about what their experiences have been. And really, I would say the goal of the show is to help educate high earning millennials and business owners on things that they should be thinking about. It's a lot of things that we've learned over the past 10 years, right? That I wish I would have known when I was an 18-year-old.
Oh, that's fantastic. So is that the best way if people want to get a hold of you, like just kind of like start there, or like you have a website?
I would say So our website is Moment. Yeah. Our website's momentprivatewealth.com. And I would say the best way to get a hold of us is either on the website. There's a contact information button if you're interested in exploring working with our firm. And then I'm super active on LinkedIn and Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it. So if you're on those platforms and you want to send me a message, I do my best to respond to everybody.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. Well, Jacob, thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. What would be a good closing thought to leave our audience with?
Play the game that you are uniquely good at. So use this analogy. If you walked into the casino, the odds are in the casino's favor. What is a game that you can play that instead of you sitting at the blackjack table and you're the customer, you're the dealer, right? Where the odds are significantly shifted in your favor. And I think a lot of that comes through skill building and experience, but everybody can do it. You just have to understand what is my skill set? What's something that I can do that I'm uniquely good at, and play the game that you are uniquely good at. Jim, thanks for having me on.
Oh, I love it. All right, guys. Well, thanks for tuning in to another Passive Wealth Show episode. I'm your host, Jim Manning, and that's a wrap. Make sure you stay tuned for the next one. Thanks, guys. All right, guys, that's a wrap. Thanks so much for tuning in. We have a website, passivewealthshow.com, where you can get more great content and resources. We offer a passive profit strategy session, and you can find that on our website as well, where we'll basically ask you a bunch of discovery questions and help you figure out if investing passively is a good thing for you or not. So go to our website, passivewealthshow.com, and we'll go from there.